Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. It's been a relatively quiet week, hasn't it? You know, we had the triumph in the North London Derby, beating Tottenham, Tottenham losing, us winning, Spurs not winning. All that stuff was fantastic and great, and there's been a little bit of fallout in terms of Ben White, which we'll talk about in a few minutes on this particular episode. But beyond that, it's been fairly quiet, at least in the context of how the last few weeks have been. There's been a game every 3 or 4 days, midweek games, and there hasn't really been any way of just switching your brain off. And I've kind of enjoyed that about this week, that The Derby win always feels good, and we've kind of been able to enjoy it over an extended period because we haven't been straight back into the saddle with a Tuesday game or a Wednesday game or something like that. So it has enabled us to enjoy the fact that we won the Derby and that Tottenham fans appear to have lost their tiny little minds. If you see some of the reaction that's been going around, people accusing Perry Groves of committing hate crimes because he celebrated an Arsenal goal in the press box at White Hart Lane or the toilet bowl, whatever it's called.
Be ashamed of yourself. You're on the radio. Calls you right here, you will. Excuse me, I'm out of a scurry, please. I want to report a hate crime.
I mean, I do think that guy was on just a little bit of a wind-up with that video, but still, remember last season when Aaron Ramsdale was so good in this game that one of their fans was so outraged and incensed at either the quality of his performance or the lack of quality in the Spurs' performance that he kicked Aaron Ramsdale and then ran off? The online reaction this week from so many Tottenham fans has been the digital equivalent of that, and I think it's very important that we take a moment to enjoy that, bask in it, and reflect on the fact that Arsenal winning a game of football can make grown adults react in that way. Is this not one of the joys of football? Driving opposition fans to distraction isn't strong enough a word, to relative insanity, because if you took a non-football fan and told them about half the stuff that we've seen this week from Tottenham fans, they'd say, that's not normal. Those people are not normal. And above and beyond being Tottenham fans, that is absolutely true. So we do have plenty to get stuck into in this particular episode. However, before we do that, I just want to give a little update on something that we have been running throughout the month of April. We pledged to give every penny of our Patreon revenue in April to UNICEF to help kids all around the world. And today, Thursday, we've done exactly that. We have rounded it up and made a donation of 50,000 euros to UNICEF, which will go to help children all over the world who are afflicted by war, by famine, by disease, by displacement, things that are completely and utterly out of their control, but which have such a big impact on their young lives. So this money will go to help them and hopefully make their lives better. And I want to say a big thank you to everybody who has been part of our Patreon for a long time, and to those of you who signed up specifically for the month of April, knowing that your subscription for this month was going to go and help a great cause and hopefully change the lives or aid the lives of many children throughout the world who absolutely and utterly need it. So I want to thank you all for being part of it and for helping this platform to give a little back to the world at a time where it feels like it's needed more than ever. So thank you again. I really, really appreciate it. Right. Let's get on with today's show. And I'm delighted to welcome back from The Telegraph. It's Sam Dean. Hi, Sam.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I want to start by talking about Ben White. There's a lot of focus on Ben White. Kind of surprising to me in a way. I don't know if it's the high profile nature of the North London Derby. Maybe you don't often see a defender fiddling with the goalkeeper's gloves, but any seasoned Arsenal watcher will not have been at all surprised by Ben White getting up to, what's a good word, antics, if you want to call it that, in the opposition penalty box when Arsenal have set pieces. Have you been at all surprised by the focus on this week?
I think from an Arsenal perspective, as you say, I think it's been a bit overblown because everyone who's watched Arsenal and watched Ben White, especially this season, but also going back, will know that he is a player who quite enjoys the antics, as you put it. And he is, I think he is sort of Arsenal's master of the dark arts, really. And that's kind of one of his roles, and he quite enjoys that and revels in it. So I certainly wasn't surprised to see him getting up to his usual tricks against Spurs. But I think obviously the high profile nature of the game and obviously the glove loosening is quite funny and B, quite unusual. So I can see why that's sort of grabbed the attention. And also clearly the fact that Arsenal scored from that corner added more focus to it and then scored again from another corner about 10 minutes later when he once again got up in Vicario's face. So I can see why there is more focus now, but it does feel a little bit like the wider world has only just realised that Ben White can be a bit of a shithouse. And we've kind of already known that for some time. I am quite surprised by the level of, I don't know whether is it anger towards him or like distaste? It feels a bit excessive. I mean, people accusing him of being a cheat, for example.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know what you think, Andrew, but for me, what he did is absolutely nowhere near as bad, for example, as when a player kicks the ball out and claims it's their throw-in when they know it's not. That's cheating. That's properly cheating, but no one has any issue with that. Whereas fiddling with the glove to annoy Vicario, that's not actually having any impact on the game. That's just trying to wind him up. So there's a bit of a difference there, and I'm quite surprised by the sort of pearl-clutching moral response to it.
There is I think that's a thing, you know, where look at a couple of the previous games where there was a really bad tackle on Kai Havertz. There was a really bad tackle on Takahiro Tomiyasu in the Wolves game and the Chelsea games. And those things are sort of like, you know, it's part of the game. Yeah, sure, he could have had his leg broken, but, you know, that's the risk you take. And then he's touched the goalkeeper's glove. What's going on here? This is absurd. You can't do that. That's disgraceful, as if it's some kind of really shocking thing that a player can do. I was really taken aback, I have to say, both after the North London Derby and this week, comments from Ange Postecoglou about how he views this kind of stuff, how he views, for example, preparation for set pieces. Because whether Spurs had 1 day or 15 days, and it's funnier, obviously, that they had 15 days to prepare for this game and then didn't do anything about Ben White when everybody in the wider world knows, A, this is what he does, and B, their goalkeeper is a little bit suspect, that they didn't put the preparation and organization into dealing with Ben White, not until the second half when, like, they just couldn't ignore it. But then there was some comments, I think, in the build-up to their game. They're playing tonight, right?
Yeah, Chelsea tonight.
They're playing Chelsea tonight. So he was asked about it again. He was asked about Ben White fiddling with the goalkeeper's gloves. This is what he said.
Mate, whether he's trying to, under his glove, tickle his armpit, I really don't care. And I try and get my players to not worry about that stuff, not focus on that stuff. It's not important, mate. Really, it isn't. And to be honest, if I saw one of my players do it, I'd be saying, mate, well, seriously, get the ball and play some football. But that doesn't mean that that's not a strategy that can be used, but I just don't buy into it. I don't care about it. Let's just play some football, man.
I mean, let's just play some football. It sounds lovely, but, you know, you can see two goals from set pieces, and the reality is that you kind of can't ignore this stuff, whether you don't like it or or that doesn't matter. You have to be aware that this is what other teams are potentially going to do. And I think there's something so fascinating about Ben White in this role, in that, like, I saw someone, I can't remember where it was, but just saying, like, what happens if Ben White is out? Who does that? Who takes up that role for Arsenal? And I'm not sure that anybody really does, because it feels like, okay, talk about Nicolas Jover and his work as a set-piece coach and the strategies and how do you undermine the opposition, how do you unsettle them, those kinds of things. It feels almost like a perfect storm that Arsenal have this singular personality in Ben White, who's quite happy to do this and enjoys this part of the game, at the same time as there's been this focus on set pieces. So, you know, it's not as if they sort of say, right, just pick someone at random and let them do that. It's like, okay, he's going to be very good at that because, you know, he just has that to his personality.
Yeah, it's kind of perfectly suited to him and his sort of competitiveness, gamesmanship, whatever you want to call it, really.
Yeah.
The one thing I would say on the Ange Postecoglou response is that I really enjoy hearing a manager saying, oh, who cares? Just because, like, there are so many questions in press conferences, and I've spent so many hours of my life sitting in press conferences where people ask questions, and I've done it myself. I'm not trying to sort of say other journalists, you know, we ask questions and you think afterwards, no one actually cares. So for managers to actually say it was just quite nice. And I think it'd be funny and refreshing if more managers admitted that. But yeah, I mean, I think the key point you make is the one that, how did Spurs not know this was coming? Like, Arsenal do this all the time. Like, Porto, for example, knew it was coming and dealt with it so well.
Yeah.
When Arsenal went away to Porto and Porto won about 47 free kicks from every time Arsenal got a corner, that was amazing, like, tactical work by them. I know it was ugly and everyone got annoyed by it, but that was what you have to do to win a game. And they did in that case. How Spurs didn't even clock that White being on Vicario could be a problem absolutely staggers me. And it goes back to that sort of set piece coach issue, which obviously you talked about with James the other day after the game, but I got some stats up, and in the Premier League this season, Spurs have scored 11 goals from set pieces and conceded 14. Arsenal have scored 22 from set pieces and conceded 6. That's a swing of 19 goals over the course of a season. Like, that's a lot of points.
Yeah.
A lot of goals, and it's a lot of points. And for Arsenal to have a set-piece specialist who has years' worth of experience and dossiers and strategies for this stuff is clearly working for them. And I think increasingly the clubs that don't have that look like they're living in the past now.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. Like, you can't pick and choose which parts of the game are to your taste. That if they exist and they're a strength for the opposition, you need to be able to counter them. It doesn't mean you have to spend your whole day doing it, but you can't just ignore them. You can't ignore those things. Do you think, you know, with this increased focus, with articles in various publications this week, even though, was it Sky Sports, I think, put together a little compilation package of Ben White's best shithousery moments? I don't know if they called it that exactly, but there was like a clip of about 60 seconds of Ben White, you know, winding up goalkeepers, winding up defenders. There was an article in The Times. There was an article in The Athletic. I'm sure there were more that I haven't seen. Will this necessitate or perhaps force a change from Arsenal, from Nicolas Jover, from Ben White? Because increased spotlight, it doesn't mean it's going to be there forever and ever, but while the spotlight is shining brightly on you, sometimes the best idea is to just step off into the shadows a little bit.
Yeah, I think if you asked Arteta or Jover, they'd say, well, it's constantly evolving anyway, we don't want to do the same moves every week for every part of the season, which I'm sure is true. If you'd asked me that question a week ago, I would have said there's no way that a Premier League opposition analysis or opponent would look at Arsenal and not realise they do this. So when people say, like, you know, for example, I might write a piece looking at sort of Saka's trademark move, for example, and I'll often get replies saying, oh, don't put this out there because the opposition will see it and they'll work on it. And I always think that's ludicrous because they have highly paid full-time analysis people who are looking at this stuff anyway. They don't need to read it in the Telegraph to know what Arsenal do. And also, they'll know it in far more depth and far more understanding than anything I've got as a journalist sitting in the press box. So that's what I would have said a week ago. Then you watch Spurs and the way they left Ben White, And you think, well, actually, maybe they don't look at this stuff. Maybe Spurs really didn't look at it, or they didn't think it was a problem. So that's kind of shaken my belief to a sort of existential level about how good these people are. Genuinely, I just, especially the second goal, the Kai Havertz second set piece goal, the way White just removes Vicario from the situation. You have to be ready for that. Yeah. I know it's not the Spurs podcast, but I'm not a Spurs fan, nor an Arsenal fan, but I was kind of annoyed watching that. Like, you have to know that's coming. Mm. It's been a whole season of this. So yeah, a week ago I would have said, of course they know it. The media makes no odds. Now I think, oh, maybe they actually are more incompetent than I thought, and the media will shine a light for some people.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. First corner against Bournemouth will be very interesting to see where Ben White goes and see what the reaction to his placement in the penalty box is. I think there's a wider issue as well, or maybe a better point to be made about Ben White, is that this focus on what he's doing from the set piece situations means there's maybe not quite as much focus on the quality and consistency of the performances that he has put in over the course of this season. I know there was a little period where people were like, oh, is he quite right? But he's been playing with a knee injury for quite some time.
Yeah.
You see him out there, whether it's in training or in a game. It's hard because I think the bandages are the same golden hue as his thighs, so it's hard to see. But he's got a fairly heavy strapping on one of his knees. But, you know, this is a guy whose defensive consistency is incredible. I think he's in the ballpark of William Saliba and Gabriel in that regard. That when you think if there's an area where Arsenal might be slightly vulnerable in defence, it tends to be down the left-hand side because there's an uncertainty about the left-back position, and some of the moments that we've had in that area of the pitch are the ones that spring to mind most quickly for me when it comes to defensive issues. But also, you know, he contributes a lot going forward. He's got 4 goals this season, 4 assists, which is 4 times as many in both categories as Antony has for Manchester United. So this is, you know, for all the talk about what he does and how he winds people up and whether it's cheating or whether it's gamesmanship, but whatever about that, the discussion about Ben White, the footballer, tends to be slightly obscured by all that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And also obscured by the England situation as well. Like a lot of the conversation around White is clouded by that. But I really think that Ben White has been probably one of Arsenal's top 3 players this season. Certainly since the Dubai break in January, he's been exceptional. What I find the most impressive and sort of striking about White is the way his game has evolved since he joined Arsenal. He came as a ball-playing centre-back who dribbled out, and in his first sort of 6 months did quite a lot of those dribbling runs. And then he stopped doing that, which I imagine was a coaching thing. Arteta saying, hang on, let's not go wild running out with the ball from the back. Then he got moved to right back, and for the first half of last season, effectively played as sort of another right-sided centre-back and didn't push on that much. Then he started to overlap a bit more and contribute a bit more going forward last year. And this year he's done all 3 things brilliantly. And as we saw around sort of February time, for example, that West Ham game, he's now at times coming in and inverting and playing that Zinchenko role from the right. So this is a guy who can pretty much do everything. And the sort of way he's added that to his game, I think, is a triumph of his personality, of his adaptability, and also of Arteta's coaching and the coaching staff, because they've added these strings to his bow. And with each season, he seems to be getting better and better. And I really wouldn't be surprised if we see more of him next year coming into midfield and taking that position up in the way that Zinchenko has for a lot of this season, or Tomiyasu has in the last few games. He's kind of got it all, and I think he's the best right back in the Premier League by some distance now. Yet, obviously, the England issue will somewhat cloud that for the foreseeable future, which is a shame. But that's the world for you, I guess.
Yeah, I think he's pretty close to. He should be in the discussion for player of the season. He probably won't get it because there are other players who do things, you know, higher up the pitch, which tend to get more focus and, you know, are more impactful maybe. But I think he's right up there, and the consistency he's shown is remarkable. Yeah. Let's leave him to one side and let's move on and talk about a different player. This is Gabriel Jesus now, who, via reporting from James yesterday in The Athletic, is a player that Arsenal might consider letting go in the summer. And I think it's important to point out that just because a club might consider an offer for a player, it doesn't mean that they think this player is useless or washed up or not useful in any way. But it is interesting, isn't it, that this is a guy who arrived at the club last season, first part of last season before he went to the World Cup. It was like, oh my God, look at what he's brought to this team, the dynamism, the movement at nine when, you know, we had been a bit static up there, it's fair to say, with someone like Alexandre Lacazette, and Jesus came in and was so integral to that amazing start to the season that Arsenal had. Even if you probably felt sometimes his finishing let him down, he was contributing a lot to the way that the team was able to play football and dominate matches and score goals, and went to the World Cup, had this injury, and I think since then probably hasn't been quite the same. I'm not quite sure where you stand on this. Is this about how quickly Mikel Arteta's team is developing and how quickly certain players can be left behind? Or is it about Jesus and maybe some worries about, you know, what his knee might be experiencing? Does he need another surgery? Is that going to impact him in the long term? You know, he's only got 4 goals in the Premier League this season. Champions League, his stats are very good based on the amount of appearances he's had, but in the Premier League, not so much. I mean, is a little from column A, a little from column B in that regard, that, you know, 18 months ago, it would have been unthinkable that now we could be considering potentially letting a player like him go because of just how impactful he was.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. It was a really good piece by James yesterday. The one thing I'd say is that Arsenal, the way they operate and the way they intend to operate, they have to consider offers for a lot of their players if there are offers to come. I would say there's probably a handful of players you would say are completely untouchable, Saka being one of them, Odegaard, Saliba. Beyond that, if someone big out there wants to pay huge money, Arsenal have to be thinking about it. And certainly with a player like Jesus, who isn't a guaranteed starter anymore, and he's not having the impact that he was having, as you say, in the first half of last season. So I think Arsenal would be foolish to not entertain offers or at least listen to them, have discussions if they come. But obviously, if they come is quite a key part. And you mentioned the knee problem, and Jesus himself has said that he might have to look at that in the summer and, you know, potentially go back in with another operation. And I would suspect that might hinder any chance of him leaving. If no one's going to want to sign a player who's got a dodgy knee and needs to fix that, especially a player who earns huge money, and Arsenal will want a big transfer fee for him because he's still got a few years left on his contract. So in terms of the strategy of Arsenal being willing to listen to offers for players, he certainly is no longer in that untouchable category. Whether an offer comes forward or not, I think we'll have to wait and see, of course, and who wants to go for him. My personal view is that Arsenal need to strengthen their front line this summer, not weaken it. And I think Jesus is a player who strengthens it. Maybe not in the way that people expected as of the first half of last season, but he can play left, as he has done quite well recently at Brighton away, for example. I thought he had a very good first half, won that penalty. They got the ball rolling. He can play right, which we know is very important if and when Saka finally gets an injury or suspension or whatever. That is going to happen at one point, Arsenal fans. I'm sorry to say it, but that is going to happen. And he can play up front, as we know. So I think Jesus is a really valuable player to have in that squad. The question is, do you want to be paying that much money to a player who is a sort of cover for the front three positions, maybe? And I can see how that would be a discussion point within the walls of Arsenal. But I think he's still got so much to offer for Arteta in this squad next year and going forward. And his personality as well. People forget that he was put into the leadership group within about 2 weeks of joining the club. And he turned up and was just like instantly, like the respect he had earned and the status he built up there said quite a lot for who he is. And I think he's not had a great season in terms of his numbers. And obviously in recent weeks has been outshone by Kai Havertz in that number nine role. But there's a lot more to come from Jesus, I think. And I would be surprised if a suitable offer did arrive. But equally, if it did, I wouldn't be surprised if Arsenal thought, yeah, now's a good chance to make some money.
I tend to agree with you in terms of what he brings to the team and the squad. I think if Arsenal were to sell Gabriel Jesus and, you know, before they sold, for example, Eddie Nketiah and Reece Nelson, they've made the squad weaker. I think the versatility is important. I think as well there's probably something about the comments he made about maybe needing an operation in the summer, about prioritizing his own fitness rather than the needs of his club or his country, which might sound a little counterintuitive because you want players to put themselves on the line for you. But I think if you look at what happened,
I think he's probably done that this season because he's been playing through pain, as he said, today quite a lot. Obviously, in the summer, he played in the preseason, played against Barcelona, got kicked around a lot, and then had to go back under the knife.
Yeah.
It reads to me, and my understanding is that he's been managing this for quite some time. And the summer will be the chance to have a sort of clean break and work on it at the expense, possibly, of the country. Right? Yeah. So he's. I think in terms of sort of commitment to the cause, I don't think anyone can question that in that sense.
Yeah, no, true. But I think maybe he's realised that if you do that, there is an impact as you get to, he's 27 now, turned 27 in April. So you kind of have to think about, right, how can I get the best out of the remaining years of my career? So do you go to a World Cup while you're managing a knee injury? Of course, you know, there are things I think that you can reassess as a footballer and perhaps focus on being more available and being fitter and prioritizing your availability, because I think we know that one of the key things for Mikel Arteta is availability. That I think there's a connection between some of the players who've been on the fringes this season and the fact that they've spent long periods out injured, whether it's Emile Smith Rowe or Fabio Vieira. I'm not saying it's their fault that they're injured, but I have a suspicion, I don't know if it's true or not, that something goes on in the back of Mikel Arteta's mind when a player is injured a lot, and whether he can trust them, whether he can even trust them to put them on as a sub at certain points. But, you know, I think there is, fitness permitting, I think you're right, that there is a lot more to come from Jesus, that there is a quality to his all-round game that is going to be really, really useful, or could be really, really useful. And I think if Arsenal, again, are going to be in the Champions League next season, I think his numbers were 4 goals and 3 assists in 8 games. So, you know, almost a goal contribution in every Champions League game so far for Arsenal this season. That also has to factor into the equation, factor into the thinking when you're doing your squad building.
What kind of price, if you were sitting there with Edu and Jason Ayto, what kind of price would you think is the sell price for Jesus?
I mean, it's such a difficult question because the market in the Premier League is very much its own thing, isn't it? It's
30? Would you take 30 for
it? I don't know. I mean, it would probably be tempting, but it would depend who it came from.
Yeah,
is 30 abroad different from 30 from another Premier League club? I'm not sure. I mean, I think there are other players. Like, when I think about how Arsenal are going to rebuild this summer, I think there are other players who, like, Jesus' position as somebody like, ooh, you'd have to think about it, is because he's got value. And the reason he's got value is because he's good.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. So there's this Simba or Catch-22 kind of thing going on there. But I look at other players in the squad and I think, you know, he would be very, very low down the list for me when you think about Nelson, Nketiah, Smith Rowe, Vieira, who I think might be in that bracket as well, where they don't necessarily want to let him go. But if an offer came in, they take it. There's the Aaron Ramsdale situation, the Thomas Partey situation, which we'll come to now in a minute in the context of Jorginho. You know, there are other priorities, I think, when it comes to outgoing players, but then you have that issue of, well, how much are they going to pay for them? And the fact that Jesus is valuable is also tied inextricably to his quality as a footballer. So it's complicated, isn't it?
It's complicated, and it's something that Arsenal, for all their many improvements and strengths over the past few years, is something they've just not done well yet. I think Edu's done a fantastic job, but there are still questions to be asked over the sales. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't want to sort of be a Debbie Downer on it, but I'm looking at this summer and the fringe players that Arsenal would be happy to lose. And I'm struggling to see a huge market for these guys. And we'll come on to Partey, so I'll leave Partey out of it. But the issue with Eddie Nketiah, for example, is that he's on massive money. My understanding is around 100 grand a week. If you're Crystal Palace, for example, that makes him effectively your highest earner. Have you seen enough from Eddie Nketiah this season to make him worth that risk, make him the highest earner in your squad? I'm not sure you have. And it's an issue partly that goes back to Arteta and the way he treats some of these fringe players. And that's not a criticism because he has to pick a team to win. But it's also unquestionably true that the value of some of his players has declined quite rapidly because of the way they've not played. Emil Smith Rowe on big money. Reece Nelson on big money.
Do you think
he's going to take these guys on the match of these salaries?
I've seen so much discussion of these salaries, but is there, were Arsenal sort of caught between a rock and a hard place to an extent with someone like Nketiah and someone like Reece Nelson where, you know, they could go for free? Realistically, Arsenal should be able to get some money for them, but because of the timing of this, that there's a sort of benchmarking element to the salaries that they've had to pay these guys, because in order to hold on to Bukayo Saka and William Saliba and Martin Odegaard, Saka and Saliba in particular, I think, because of the contractual situations that they were in, they've had to pay them salaries which are commensurate with their abilities, obviously, and with their talent and what they bring to the team. But that also means that when there's a renewal for Eddie Nketiah or an offer on the table for Reece Nelson, the agents are saying, well, look, clearly he's no Saka. Clearly he's no Saliba. But is he one-third of a Saka? Or, you know, and that has sort of not quite tied Arsenal's hands when it comes to giving those salaries and giving those contracts, but it is a consequence of the renewals of some of our best players.
Yeah, and also a consequence of the timing of those renewals. Eddie and Reece Nelson were both right at the end of their deals, so they were effectively free agents, and their offers they would have got elsewhere at that point would have been higher as a result. So Arsenal needed to sort of fork out more in order to keep them. And I got the logic, and I still get the logic of doing those deals and keeping them rather than letting them go for free. Because, for example, getting a backup winger who can play on both sides if required but isn't that fussed about not playing every week would probably cost more to sign one of those than it would to give Reece Nelson a new contract. But 2 years down the line, suddenly Arsenal have some sort of they want to make some PSR headway and something to work with, and selling these guys. I might be wrong. In a few weeks' time, there might be offers on the table for Reece Nelson and Eddie Nketiah and money rolling in. And I suspect Smith Rowe probably will have offers just based on his reputation and what he did 2 years ago. So I might be wrong, but I suspect that the high wages will make it quite complicated. And I think Arsenal fans, like fans of all clubs, like to go through the squad and list how much is he worth, how much we get for him, how much we get for him. And I would expect if you surveyed 100 Arsblog readers or listeners, what will you get for Eddie Nketiah? I suspect the reality will be quite a lot less than what most of them are expecting.
Yeah, maybe so. And that might be a consequence of the wages that you have to take a hit in terms of the transfer fee that you get.
Yeah.
Albeit, you know, if you do get money in for Eddie and Reece Nelson, it is good for PSR. It is booked as, I think, pure profit. I don't know quite exactly how it works because they're academy graduates. So we'll see. Before we just come on to the Jorginho thing, we've talked about Gabriel Jesus as a player who came in and was really influential. And I think the same is true of Alexander Zinchenko last season, that it, you know, now obviously things are a little bit different, but I think it would be wrong to overlook the impact that he had on the development and the progress of the team last season in particular. And things, you know, change quickly in football. Is he another one who Arsenal would and should be prepared to listen to offers for? I'm not sure the player himself would be particularly keen on leaving or departing, but the reality of Arsenal's left-back situation, whether it's Jurrien Timber who plays there next season, whether it's a signing in the summer, even with the options that we have right now, Zinchenko's place in the pecking order is lower than it was. You know, he was very clearly the first choice left back. Now he's not. He could be second choice, depending on the game. He could be third or fourth choice left back. And again, we're talking about somebody who came in, had a big impact, and now is considered somebody who Arsenal could potentially move on.
Yeah. I think the argument about Arsenal moving on from the player is a lot more applicable to Zinchenko than it is to Jesus, in my view. I certainly think these last few weeks and Arteta's kind of reluctance to use him has been quite instructive of how he views it. As you say, Zinchenko was great last season, and I think he's still got a lot to offer, but it seems clear to me that there's this slightly weird atmosphere around him now, and it's made me a little bit uncomfortable, to be honest, and you can hear it at the ground a lot. It feels like sometimes Arsenal fans always kind of have something to argue about, and in the last few months, that's kind of been Zinchenko, and people saying he's a liability, others saying he brings so much more that it's worth the risk, and I think the point James made before in the podcast is that he feels a bit like a relic of last season with the chaos and the risk and reward factor, and I think that's true, and I agree with that. My feeling on Zinchenko is against a team like a Burnley at home, for example, when Arsenal know they're going to dominate the ball, I think he's really valuable in those kind of games. He can pick a pass, he can control the flow of a game, he can cause all sorts of problems and pose all sorts of questions that Tomiyasu, for example, can't. And maybe Timber can, we don't know yet. Obviously, we've not seen him enough. So I think he's really valuable in that sense. But is it worth having someone on big money just to play against teams where Arsenal could dominate possession? Maybe the answer is yes. And maybe, again, it comes back to how much of a market there is for him, because he's quite a specific player. Yeah. Like, you wouldn't sign him if you're a promoted team, for example, or you're playing a 4-3-3 with a bombing forward left back. You kind of need to play a certain style of football if you want to have Zinchenko in your team, which probably limits the kind of clubs who would be in for him and where he might go. Again, the wages are quite big, coming from Man City, 30 million, 2 years on his deal. I'm not convinced it's going to be a huge market for him, but I certainly do think if there was an offer, it would make a lot more sense to me for him to leave than Jesus in the equivalent scenario.
What about the argument you see people make it that, well, he plays where he plays for Ukraine. He's a number 10 by trade. Is there an argument that as somebody who could play further forward for Arsenal, you eliminate some of the defensive frailties and some of the defensive flaws that impact the team, and you get a player who, as you say, is creative, can pick a pass, can wriggle out of tight situations, can do a job, you know, beyond the halfway line, and perhaps be impactful there, albeit we've never really seen any inclination from Mikel Arteta about using him in that way? And it's not as if he hasn't been asked, because I'm sure you've been in press conferences where he has been asked, well, what about using him a little bit further forward? And he kind of fudges the issue and doesn't really dwell on it in any way. But it might also factor into, you know, potential transfer somewhere else, that someone could look at Zinchenko and say, yeah, no way am I going to play him at left back. But as somebody who could come into a team and be part of a creative trio in midfield, or, you know, play as a left eight, for example, there is clearly talent and ability there that might open that door.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, there's an element of risk there if you're the buying club, given that he never really did it for Man City and he's not done it for Arsenal. Mm. And obviously, international football with Ukraine is a slightly different level and not quite the same consistency of performances. There's a level of risk there, certainly for someone of his age and his wage demands and the transfer fee that would be required. But yeah, I find it curious that Arteta's never once even half tried it, as far as I can remember. I mean, obviously his response would be, well, he does play in midfield when he rolls inside, when he has the ball, like he does both. And I get that. But obviously what we're talking about here is sort of starting there and playing there more regularly. The fact that they've signed Kai Havertz in the summer to play in that left eight role was another indication that they just don't see Zinchenko in that position. Whereas I think stylistically, there probably are quite a few similarities to Granit Xhaka. for example, that they could have evolved that to a degree with Timber coming in and Xhaka going and Zinchenko moving forward. But there's just simply been no inclination from Arteta at any point that he fancies Zinchenko there. Maybe that's to do with physicality, the sort of the energy required and the running required in that position. And one of the things, for example, that Arsenal love about Kai Havertz and one of the reasons they went for him was his ability to cover ground, just to eat up the space and just get box to box, box to box for 90 minutes. I don't think Zinchenko's got that. And that might be one of the reasons why Arteta's not put him there. But yeah, you're right. We've asked a few times in press conferences and funnily enough, he's never detailed why he doesn't fancy Zinchenko further forward. we can keep trying, but he's never quite going to go there, I don't think.
I think you're probably right about the physical side of it. Like he tends to be, I don't know if I'm doing him a disservice, but he feels very often like a 70-minute player. You do get players like that. I think Lacazette, to an extent, was like that, a 70-minute player who, in the final stages of a game, probably runs out of steam a little bit. So that could go some way to explaining it.
Yeah, and also, I mean, like comparing to Havertz, like Havertz looks like a cross-country runner. Mm. He just goes and goes, like his legs are whirring. Whereas Zinchenko, just physically, like even the way he moves in his running style, his gait is just very different. He's a lot more close to the ground and sort of less powerful as an athlete. So I suspect that is part of it, but probably not the whole picture.
No. All right. Another story this week came via David Ornstein that Arsenal have offered Jorginho a new deal. There was a clause in the contract which would have allowed them to extend it by another year, but that's run out or it's not been applicable. So they're offering fresh terms. It is probably a two-year deal because his age, he is going to want some measure of security. He is expected to sign this deal. Are you surprised at all? I mean, he's a player that Mikel Arteta really, really likes. I remember when Arteta took over first, maybe it was just before the pandemic or I can't remember, but there was a lot of talk in that January window maybe about bringing in Jorginho, and he's somebody he's admired for a long time. He's 32 now. I don't know, sometimes a player, even though they're 32, if you don't have any pace to lose, you know, it's not a big issue when you get to the latter stages of your career. So it looks like he is going to stay. Any thoughts on that and any surprise that the club have decided to extend him?
No, not really, because I think if you talk to anyone at Arsenal or even the other players, the regard in which Jorginho is held is quite striking. It's interesting because at Chelsea, obviously, he had a kind of leadership role there too, but I don't think he was always the most popular man at Chelsea. And I think when he came in, some people I spoke to who know Chelsea well or contacts were saying, oh, we'll be interesting to see how he fits in. But what he has done is absolutely kind of embrace Arsenal and his role within the team. I think he knows now that he's not going to play 90 minutes every week and he's got to manage his fitness and he's got this young buck, Declan Rice, running around after him and that kind of thing. And he's almost taking on like a part coach, part player role, especially on the touchlines, I think, as fans will have seen, like, when he's on the bench, he's actually on the touchline pointing and shouting and gesturing towards the team. So I view him as one of the players who's kind of Arteta's eyes on the field. And I also think there's value to having someone with his experience in that squad. If you look at it, I know they're getting a bit older. Obviously, that's the way time works. You get older as it goes on.
you don't have to tell me, Sam, honestly.
Yeah. Odegaard, Ben White, Saka, they've been around for a few years now. They know what they're doing. It's not like it was in the summer of 2021. But I still think Arsenal are a young squad with limited experience. And Jorginho having that makes him very valuable too, as well as his personality and his quality on the pitch. Obviously, what it does do is raise questions about Thomas Partey. I'm sure that was sort of what we're heading towards conversation-wise. You'd expect one of them to go, wouldn't you?
Yeah. It felt either or to me, you know, with regards, because Elneny's going to go. Arsenal have been linked with central midfielders. It feels like that is going to be one of the signings of the summer as a central midfielder. We don't quite know who, we don't quite know what profile. And then you're left with a decision about Partey or Jorginho. Where do you put your chips down? I think you know, this, the fact that they have offered this deal to Jorginho that he is expected to sign does raise questions about Partey's future and what might happen with him in this summer.
It says to me that Arsenal are confident of getting Partey out the door. Now, I don't know if that's because they've got something lined up or they're expecting something or they're hoping they can. Because, and not to repeat myself on the previous issue, but like Partey, probably more than anyone like Eddie Nketiah or Reece Nelson, where's the market for Partey? This guy's on massive money. He's one of Arsenal's highest earners, and he's played about 5 games all season because of injury record. If you are a club in Europe, for example, would you put that money on the table? I don't think you would. It doesn't seem sensible. Obviously, there's been talk and whispers about Saudi for some time. Mm-hmm. It feels a little bit like that's kind of Arsenal's best chance of getting rid of him, which sounds a bit blunt, but I think that is kind of the reality as it stands. Unless someone in Italy or Spain or wherever comes forward with a load of cash for him, then fine. But of all the players, and this was true last year too, a lot of people saying last year, Partey will get sold 2 years left in his deal. Yeah, it's a great idea to sell him, but it's not that easy. To sell, you need to have a buyer. And when a player earns that much and has played this little, it makes it quite tricky. So I do worry a little bit for Arsenal where they're going to get the buyer from, unless it's Saudi, in which case, jolly good, shake your hand, thanks very much, and go buy a new midfielder with the money you get.
Yeah.
The only surprise for me with the Jorginho thing is sort of the timing of it. And I guess that's for Jorginho's sake because he needs to make decisions too. But
yeah,
if Arsenal had full control over this and Jorginho said, whenever you want, I'm happy, I suspect they would have happily waited until closer to the window starting so they could get more of a feel for what party's up to.
Yeah,
I really would not be surprised at all, if Arsenal start next season with Jorginho, Rice and Partey all in the squad still as those 3 midfield sixes.
Wouldn't be a surprise. I'm not sure it's exactly what Arsenal would want, because if they do bring in another... I mean, you're right about having to find a buyer, because I think there was a point last summer where Arsenal would have been, if not happy, but prepared to move Thomas Partey on. And then, obviously he stayed, and it is about finding a buyer. I thought the little adjunct to David's tweet about Jorginho signing a new deal, Edu and Jason Ato make Saudi Arabia trip. No players/deals discussed. Okay. All right, they're just there for a bit of vitamin D and sunshine. I think there's probably some groundwork going on there, and maybe it's not related to Thomas Partey. Maybe it is. I don't quite know, but
Any good Premier League club right now will be looking at Saudi and thinking, that is my get-out clause for a bad deal. Those are the guys with all the money, no restrictions. They can take my problems away and give me some cash for it. Look at what Chelsea did last year. The amount of players Chelsea flogged to Saudi Arabia who had no market in Europe. Saudi Arabia saved their bacon completely. And from Arsenal's point of view, it must be absolutely galling that the Saudi investment began sort of in the last 18 months and not 3 or 4 years ago. Can you imagine how happily Arsenal would have sent the likes of Mustafi, Ozil, Socrates, even Aubameyang?
Yeah.
Send them off to Saudi Arabia. No problem at all. Off you go. You get the money in. All those terminations that Arsenal had to go through, all that nastiness that Arsenal had to swallow, would have probably not happened if Saudi was there. Like someone like Ozil, for example, would have been primed for Saudi a few years ago.
Sure.
Would have sold Arsenal's problems lovely. So the timing of it is just really unfortunate for Arsenal, and not the first time in history that the financial timing and landscape has worked against Arsenal, which I guess we'll come on to shortly. It makes perfect sense for any top European club to be out there making friends in Saudi Arabia and sort of battering your eyelids and sort of showing an ankle to them.
What do you make of, if let's say Arsenal are prepared to let Partey go or move Partey on this summer, how do you put that in the context of the last 2 games where Partey has been back in the side? Arsenal beat Chelsea 5-0. He was in the team for the 3-2 win over Spurs. you know, I really thought maybe that game would be Jorginho rather than Partey, but Arteta is leaning into the quality. Is that, you know, a sign that he is somebody he'd like to keep, or is this just sort of, okay, this is pragmatic, I've got to win games, this is the business end of the season, on the pitch, he can give me something that I want right now, and then come the summer, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think if you're picking a team to win a game, and everyone's fully fit, Partey's in it. I think he's that good. Like we saw last season how good he is. I think he's a brilliant football player and he makes Arsenal better when he's fit and when he's in it. But the reality of football is that there are also things like balance sheets and contracts and wages. And with 1 year left on his contract, Arsenal has to be ready to sell him.
And his injury record as well must play a part. Yeah,
exactly. So two questions. One, is he in Arsenal's best team when fit? I think the answer is yes. But two, does that mean Arsenal should not sell him? And the answer is no. So it's a bit of a fiddly one. I'm sure from a coaching point of view, Arteta would not object to another year of Partey available in his squad because we know how much Arteta rates him and what the players say about him and how good he can be. And I thought he was very good against Spurs, for example. I know he lost the ball quite early on, but after that, I thought he was really very impressive. And I do think he offers some things in there that no one else in that squad can do. But and the key but is there are other things to take into account with him: age, wage, injury situation, contract length, and all of those things to me point towards him leaving if they can find a buyer.
All right. Well, look, summer will tell us plenty about what's going to happen to Arsenal's midfield, who's going to stay, who's going to go, who's going to arrive. That's down the line a little bit. I did want to ask you as well this week, there was an interesting vote held by Premier League clubs, which is about exploring measures to put a cap on player spending. I think the word anchoring is used. So this would be basically a multiple of the broadcast income paid to the lowest team in the Premier League. They're talking about it being four or five times that. And that would be like a hard cap on what you can spend on players. There were, you know, all these things that the Premier League does have to be voted on by Premier League clubs. So the clubs vote for these things. I think 16 clubs voted in favor. Chelsea abstained, which seems kind of funny. And those who voted against were Manchester United, Manchester City, and Aston Villa, which I guess you can understand for various reasons. But I mean, is this kind of measure overdue? Do you think, does this go some way perhaps to controlling how clubs use their resources in, look, I don't think anything in this era could be described as fair necessarily, but something at least adjacent to that?
Yeah, it's obviously a complicated one. I think the key thing to note is that it's not sort of nailed on and definitely happening. It's just going to progress to the next level of discussions. And if this rule of around of anchoring was applied to this season, only Chelsea would have been in breach. So like, it's not like it's going to really, really cut back a lot of the spending that's been done. It's not like an era of reckoning is coming for Premier League clubs, but it is more control and it is a way for effectively clubs to limit how much their owners can pump in. And we know, I'm sure all the fans know, that Arsenal as a club are in favour of tighter financial restrictions and self-sustainability. So Arsenal's view basically is they want to run their club based on what they earn as a club. They don't want to be reliant on the Kroenkes putting money in, and the Kroenkes don't want to put that money in themselves. They could, but that's not how they operate.
And have. It's fair to say they have.
They could and have. They have because they had to get back Champions League to be self-sustainable. So that's what they want to do. But self-sustainability doesn't work if you've got Newcastle and Man City and Gulf States effectively just pouring in hundreds of millions of pounds, or Chelsea, for example, American owners. Obviously, it creates an unfair playing field, is the argument. So Arsenal are loosely in favour of this. The counter argument is that it will effectively prevent the less big clubs from competing. if you're reliant on the resources you generate from your stadium, from, you know, commercial income, all that stuff, that skews the balance in favour of historically big clubs like Arsenal, Manchester United, Liverpool, etc. The other concern, obviously, is that this anchoring, this limit, is effectively going to become a salary cap of sorts on the players. And I think those who are against anchoring and against tighter controls would say the best players will go where the money is. And if it comes to a point where anchoring is limiting what Premier League clubs can offer players, then they will go somewhere else, whether that's Italy, Spain, Germany, Saudi Arabia, whatever.
I mean, I do think I understand that point of view, but I don't think there is anywhere for those players to go. Obviously, Saudi Arabia, but there's the competitive element of that where I don't think, you know, high-profile players in the prime of their careers are going to go to Saudi Arabia, because where's the glory in that, if you know what I mean? Like, winning the Premier League or winning the Champions League is what it's about now.
That wasn't the case 20, 30 years ago.
No. I mean, I know it skews and, it, you know, go back to when Serie A was the richest league in the world, and all the biggest salaries and all the biggest transfer fees were happening there. But I think it seems unlikely to me that another country, one of the top five leagues, could develop their own league in the same way that the Premier League has in order to overtake it or even be competitive with it to an extent. You're always going to have these big clubs. You're going to have your Barcelona, your Real Madrid, AC Milan, Bayern Munich, all of those clubs which will retain a certain amount of stature. But I just don't really see that there's anywhere that can compete with the Premier League, even if there is some measure of a cap. And even if there was, there are probably ways around it, as we've seen down the years. Loopholes in these things exist all the time, where whether it's image rights or some other thing that they make up in order to give a player, you know, the money that they're looking for.
Yeah. I agree in the short term, medium term. I would say in the long term, you just don't know. Like the Saudi ball could just keep rolling and rolling and rolling, and suddenly that's the place everyone wants to go. It seems unlikely, I agree, but it's possible. The other issue in all this stuff is associated party transactions, which has three words, could hardly be more boring, but are actually quite important. For example, I'm sure you saw Chelsea sold £75 million worth of hotels to themselves to get through PSR effectively. And like, that's allowed in the Premier League, which clearly I think a lot of people would look at and say, that's nonsense. You shouldn't be able to dodge PSR for those reasons.
Of course.
If Chelsea have managed to avoid a PSR breach because of that, then obviously there'll be a lot of people with raised eyebrows, to say the least. So there's a lot of things going on right now that are really interesting and will effectively determine the future of Arsenal, really. I mean, if this stuff comes in, I think Arsenal would feel quite confident that they are well-placed in a controlled financial world.
Mm-hmm.
They're well-placed to kick on and develop and potentially even dominate. If it fails, or the associated party transactions aren't, you know, tightened up, like, what's stopping, for example, the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia buying up half of Newcastle's flat buildings or whatever, to generate money that way? So there has to be some control in that sense. The other argument, and it's one I'm kind of, sometimes I wake up and think about this because I'm a really cool guy like that. So, you know, it's the sort of thing that's on my mind. If I went and bought a fish and chip shop in Dublin, for example,
sure,
I could do what I wanted to do with it. It's my shop. It's my business. If I wanted to put all the money on ice cream and not sell any chips, I could do it.
Yeah.
And yet in football, you can buy a Premier League club, but then you've got a whole industry telling you, oh, no, you can't spend that much on that player and you can't spend that much on this player. So I kind of sometimes find myself thinking, it's a free world. It's a capitalist society. If Newcastle want to spend $1 billion on players, then they can. But obviously, I understand the argument against it, very obviously. But you see what I mean? Like, it's sometimes an existential crisis of mine.
No, I get it. I suppose there do have to be guidelines and things because, you know, a fish and chip shop, you're competing with the fish and chip shop down the road, right? But there is a sporting element, and I think there is a word that's used often in terms of sport, which is integrity. And you can question how much integrity there is in sport in general in the Premier League, but at the heart of it, if people don't feel like there is an undercurrent or a through line of integrity through the competition, then it has a negative impact on that competition ultimately, right? So Newcastle can spend £1 billion on players, but Newcastle then win everything and nobody watches the Premier League anymore because it's boring as fuck.
Whereas,
yeah, something like that, you know. Whereas, you know, you are selling a fucking shitload of ice cream because actually it turns out the people in that neighborhood have had their fill of chips and they just love your ice cream. You know, that that could work for you, but I think in sport it's a little different.
The other argument against all this anchoring stuff and effectively limiting what you can pay players and pay for players is, in that case, where's the money going to go? So let's say you've got all the money coming in, but you can only spend a certain limit of that, five times the bottom club's broadcast earnings. The money is still coming in to the Premier League. The answer is it probably goes to the owners and the executives, not the players. And I think there's an argument there while saying, well, hang on, if Arsenal make £1 billion in a year, but can only spend half of that on players, transfers and agents fees, then where's the other 500 million going to go? Maybe on infrastructure, that would be great. Maybe on staff costs in sort of the executive level, and I don't know if that falls under the wage bill or not. You know, maybe on community projects, that would be great. But I think for a lot of clubs and a lot of owners, they'd say, great, that's mine.
Mm.
And we don't want the money trickling up to people in suits. We want, if anyone's going to get the money, which is coming in because of the product, it should be the guys creating the product, and that's the football players.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, I think the obvious answer to this is that the owners would make sure that the fans benefit by lowering ticket prices.
I'm sure they will. Yeah, no doubt.
Anyway, final thing, right? NBC, the head of NBC has been talking about conversations with the Premier League about how the door looks ajar, or that's Richard Masters says this, the door looks ajar for matches abroad. And the head of NBC says, we've had conversations with the Premier League. They've been very open and receptive to listening to me about the idea of games taking place in the US, for example. He'd like to see a couple of games on the opening day of the season take place in the States. NBC are the rights holders for the Premier League over there. And obviously the US is a huge market. And as you know, fine, well, we've been out there and you've seen firsthand the level of passion that there is for Arsenal and for all the other Premier League clubs. Is this just another one of those conversations that tends to happen every couple of years? The 39th game, they float this idea, the reaction is such that they can't go ahead with it. And the reality actually is probably such that they should not go ahead with it, because imagine you're a fan of Arsenal or you're a fan of Bournemouth or whatever, and your opening game of the new Premier League season, the sunshine day in August, the one everyone's looking forward to with such optimism. Well, this game is taking place in Austin or somewhere, you know, in the US. It's completely unfair to the fans of that particular club. So does that sort of fundamental unfairness and what the reaction would be from the fans who go and pay their season tickets and pay their ticket prices every single week, does that basically preclude this ever happening? Or is it a case that at some point the money will talk and this might happen?
I hope it precludes it for everything you say about integrity of the competition and the fans who go on and pay their tickets, local fans. What's interesting is that I was on pre-season tour this summer with Chelsea first. I did a week with Chelsea, then I switched to Arsenal in LA. And as part of the Chelsea games, they played in Philadelphia against Brighton. But before that, I can't remember if it was before that or after that. And the fact that I can't remember is probably quite instructive in its own right. It was like Brentford against Newcastle or Brentford against Villa. They had like a Premier League Cup and Fulham are out there. It might be Brentford v Fulham. And this massive stadium in Philadelphia, this NFL arena, was pretty much empty. Like there was no one there. Maybe like a couple of thousand max. So when you say, like, we see the appetite in America for these clubs, I think, yeah, we do for Arsenal, for Man United, for Liverpool. But I don't think we do so much for the other Premier League clubs still and there's the smaller ones. I don't think there's a – and I might be wrong and American listeners can tell me so, and that's absolutely fine. But I don't think there's a huge appetite out there for Brentford v Aston Villa, for example.
Sure.
So it's going to be skewed towards big clubs like so much of football is. And again, that raises even more questions about who's going to go and when, and is it going to be worth it, and all those things. My personal view is that it feels inevitable that there will be some sort of Premier League thing in America. And the Premier League Cup was the thing this summer, and it was, I think, moderately successful, and I think, you know, fine. And it suited clubs like Brentford to go there and spread the good word about the bees and all that stuff. I wonder if something like the Community Shield, just put that in America, keep them happy with that. I know it's not a Premier League game, but like, there must be ways of just taking that out of Wembley, which gets a lot of games, and putting it there. I also wouldn't be surprised maybe if the FA Cup final one day goes there. I know that sounds almost like sacrilegious to some people, and I can understand why, but like, the one-off games are the ones that are the real opportunity without skewering the league. And Community Shield, FA Cup finals, end of season tournaments, pre-season tournaments, those are all the things that they can do this with. I mean, you go to America a lot, and you go there with all the tours, don't you? And you've seen the passion there. Should we as English fans be so sort of sneering towards this? We're not entitled to, it's not our football.
Well, no, I don't think it's a sense of entitlement. And I have to say, you know, from many of the fans that I've spoken to, like, I don't think the majority of them would say, yeah, bring the Premier League. You know, we are entitled to have Premier League games in the US because we are fans or big fans. I mean, you could make that argument for fans all around the world. I've been in Australia, I've been everywhere, or lots of places, and Arsenal and Premier League clubs are supported in huge fashion all over the world. So everybody could make the case that, right, well, we need a game in Japan, or we need a game in China, or we need a game in Australia, or we need a game in the US. I think fundamentally, and I'm saying this as an Irish guy who started a website about Arsenal when I was living in Spain, that if you choose to follow, or if you're a supporter of an English football team, then I think your expectation, if you want to go and see that football team outside of the occasions where they come to do preseason or play some friendlies, if you have an expectation of going to see that club in a competitive game, it's got to be where they play, which is in England, or maybe you go to a European game, you get to a Champions League game, something like that. So I don't think it's sneering. I think there is an element to which you have to protect, again, going back to integrity or history, or you know, what has attracted all these fans all around the world to Arsenal, to the Premier League, to Liverpool, to Manchester United. What has attracted them? It is what the Premier League gives them, because of the rivalries, the locality, the geography, the stadiums, all of that is what has attracted people to the Premier League. And I think that really fundamentally needs to be protected in a competitive sense.
Yeah, totally agree. The other thing, and I guess the medium-term issue, is that as of this season, 9 of the Premier League clubs are owned by Americans or have some like significant US investment. You only need 14 to make a vote and change the rules in the Premier League. So we're really not that far away from having 14 American owners. And at that point, they can quite literally do what they want.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are restrictions and the government will get involved and all those other things that, you know, that you can kind of wheel out in times of crises. But I mean, the fact that nine of the 20 are currently American-owned, effectively.
That's a very good point. I do think there is something quite different about the U.S. ownership culture, how they view the potential for the product or the franchising or whatever. I think there is something there that could potentially come into play down the line because, you know, there are NFL games in London, for example.
Yeah.
So this isn't completely out of their wheelhouse. It doesn't feel as wrong to these guys who own the clubs as it would do to you or I or fans of whichever club, you know? So
yeah, and like, you know, those they don't have relegation in the NFL.
Yeah,
like that's partly what was behind the Super League, and it was sort of this sort of bafflement from some American owners of, hang on, why would Arsenal be able to get relegated? That's ridiculous. We're Arsenal. It's like, well, yeah, well, that's how we work over here, and it's it's very different. But that kind of culture clash is becoming more and more of a live issue with every time an American owner buys a Premier League club.
Yeah.
So watch this space, I think.
Yeah, hopefully some way down the line. All right, we had better leave it there. Sam, pleasure to talk to you as always. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, as ever. Cheers.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thank you very much indeed to Sam. Hope you enjoy that conversation. You can find him on Twitter. He is at Sam J. Dean, at Sam J. Dean. Obviously, there is a big game for Arsenal taking place this weekend. The early kickoff on Saturday, 12:30 against Bournemouth at home. For more on that game, you can join us over on Patreon. Myself and Lewis Ambrose will do our usual Premier League preview podcast for you on Friday afternoon. That'll take place after Mikel Arteta's press conference tomorrow. That takes place about 1:30. We'll have the podcast for you around 4-ish, 4:30 in the afternoon. So please do join us for that if you would like to hear more about that game, what we think might happen, team selections, and all the rest. It's patreon.com/arseblog. For now, I'm going to leave it there. Thanks again for being with us, for listening, downloading, sharing, all of that stuff that you do every week. It's hugely appreciated. For now, take it easy, folks, and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye. Welcome back to Holy God FM. And that last track was Kendrick Lamar, who's written a very nice diss track about the devil himself, or as other people call him, Drake. Now we have a letter here from a listener who says, "Dear Holy God FM, I am in a bit of a quandary. Things have not been going so well for me at work, and I'm a bit concerned that they might get rid of me this summer. What advice would you give so I can prove to my employers that I'm worth sticking with?" And the letter comes from, oh, Jesus. Well, Jesus. I assume that means good Jesus or God Jesus. Which makes sense, you know, because Jesus is God and God is Jesus and the Holy Spirit and all that Trinity stuff, like the Matrix. Well, good Jesus, all I can say to you is have faith in your own ability and trust that you can deliver on the big stage. And if you can do a little miracle, make sure those financial bastards in their light blue jerseys with their 115 charges drop a couple of points along the way. Okay, time for some more music here on Holy God FM. And this is from her new album, which is also an old album, but it's back out again, so it's new. This is a song about a man who applauded when he shouldn't have. It's called Hate Crime.
Harry meant no harm, he was just having fun, partying in the stands, under the shine.
Just a silly game.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.